Beloved, in this Sunday's sermons, especially three things are of note as regards Jacob's external biography. First of all, he leaves Haran after some 20 years. Second, and following upon that, he reaches the land of Canaan, or more precisely, its northeast region, namely Gilead, back in the Promised Land. And third, he takes his leave of Laban, never, and I'm sure it didn't hurt him that much, but never to see him again. And we'll deal especially with his parting words in the evening sermon later today. So Jacob's family then departed Haran on camels. Jacob's wives, probably including his two concubines, were on camels. Jacob's 11 sons, probably plus Dinah and any other daughters he had gotten from his two wives and two concubines, they were also on camels. And they headed off, a couple of dozen camels, let's say, with all their possessions and livestock, especially in that camp were a lot of speckled, spotted, and streaked sheep and goats, as we saw last Sunday. And they were in a hurry. Laban was gone sheep shearing, and Jacob wanted to put a good distance between his party and Laban before his uncle ever heard that he was gone. So they departed in haste. Verse 21 says that they even crossed the river, that is the river Euphrates, and they traveled as fast as the marked ovines would permit. But our text tells us that Rachel had taken advantage of her father's absence and stolen his images, his teraphim, his little household gods. Verse 19. And you're wondering, what in the world are little household gods doing in the house of Laban? Well, we'll deal with that this evening. And what in the world is Rachel doing in the book of Genesis, stealing household gods? What indeed? Some say that Rachel, in taking his gods, planned to stop Laban from using them to divine, because you could use these images to divine. She didn't want to stop him using these images to divine both the fact and especially the way of their departure. And that said to try and clear Rachel's good name. But even if that is the case, there's a lot of superstition in her mind if she thinks that that can be done with these idols. The truth is probably worse than that. She stole these idols because she wanted these idols for herself, which betrays a grievous spiritual weakness in Rachel. If she'd only wanted to stop her father in using them, she could have destroyed them or taken them with her and then buried them. But she didn't do that. She still has them many days after she stole them. And in Genesis 35, it would appear that she wasn't the only one in Jacob's household who dallied around with little images or idols. And we'll come to that, Lord willing, in due case and due course in a few weeks' time. So 3 days after Jacob's departure, Laban hears of it. He swiftly does two things. He rounds up a posse of his brethren, and he goes to consult his images. But they're gone. And we know that he went to consult his images because when he finds them later, he asks, "Have you taken my images?" And then he and his posse set off after Jacob in hot pursuit and in a burning rage. But on the sixth night of the chase, when Laban's party has almost caught up with Jacob's party, Laban receives a revelatory dream. God says to Laban in a dream, "Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad." And that's a short message. And it raises the question, what are we to understand by this? And I believe the key to understanding this, as the key to understanding a lot of things that involve Laban, is to ask, what is his key characteristic? Greed. What is it that greedy Laban wants? He wants the return of all those beautiful flocks that he still thinks really belong to him. And, just for good measure, he wants the return of his daughters and their children, because he still thinks, being incredibly greedy and foolish, that they're sort of his too. And so the word of God, "Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad," means don't say anything, quote unquote, good to Jacob, that is, in this context, in order to wheedle him to come back, in order to flatter him or cajole him with words of promise. Don't say anything good to try and get him back to reclaim what you think is your property. And don't say anything bad to him either. Do not threaten him with force, pointing to all the brethren that you've brought with you, to intimidate him, to get him to go back or take his possessions from him. "Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob anything good or bad, Laban." In other words, you must recognize that they're gone. Don't even try it. Now, when you take a step back from the text, you realize that God could, of course, done a lot of other things to Laban on that sixth night. He could have killed him for a start. That way would have ensured that Jacob could have continued merrily on his journey. He could have given him a dream and said this to him: "You must return home next morning. Let Jacob go." But he didn't. The Lord has a wise purpose, and he wills to achieve two things here. He desires Jacob to go back to the promised covenant land, and he wants Jacob to go back to this promised land, secondly, not without this meeting, this confrontation at Galilee. Because Jehovah is not only interested in guiding Jacob's steps, he also is busy purifying and sanctifying his wayward servant. He's aiming, in other words, through this confrontation, at Jacob's renewal, chastisement, and sanctification. Let's look then at Jacob and Laban's confrontation at Galilee. First, Laban's fierce charges. And we've covered basically 17 through 24 in our introduction. So now we're on to verses 25 through 35. And then Jacob's firm retort, verses 36 through 42. Jacob and Laban's confrontation. Now, I know some of you don't like confrontation, but it's in our text, so we're going to go ahead with it. Jacob and Laban's confrontation at Galilee, Laban's fierce charges, followed by Jacob's firm retort. Now, when Laban's party finally caught up with Jacob's party on the mountains of Gilead after 7 days of hot pursuit, the old uncle and father-in-law immediately launches into a furious tirade against Jacob. You can imagine him stewing on this for 7 days on the back of his mount, What am I going to say to him when I get up? And the speech he gives here, and you can look out for it when we go through it, has a lot to do with you, pointing the finger, so to speak, and me. What you, Jacob, have done to me. And I'm angry about it. Listen closely. What hast thou done that thou hast stolen away unawares to me and carried away my daughters as captives taken with the sword? Wherefore didst thou flee away secretly and steal away from me and didst not tell me that I might have sent thee away with mirth and with songs and with tabret and with harp and hast not suffered me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Thou, and he's wagging his finger in his face, thou hast now done foolishly in so doing. You could say, and there's a fair bit of repetition in those charges, that Laban is laying it on thick. He's laying it into him, and he's laying it on thick with bitter reproaches. Jacob, in short, and I've just proved it, you say you're a child of God and a patriarch to whom has been given the covenant promises of God, but really, you're just a scoundrel. That's all you are. You've stolen away from me after how good I've been to you these last 20 years like a thief. You've kidnapped my daughters, my own daughters. You have no respect for your own dear father-in-law. But when you look at what he says, you have to conclude that there's a lot of his raging and it's just lies and hypocrisy. Here's one lie. You have carried away my daughters as captives taken with the sword. That is, you're treating my daughters like POWs. POWs, like captives taken by the sword. You're like a bandit who has come into my family and stolen my daughters as prey of war. And yet, and we saw this last week, Rachel and Leah came willingly with Jacob, who is, after all, their husband. He explained to them, a little bit biased as we saw, but he explained to them, enlarged the situation, and he said to them, will you come with me? And they gladly came with him. Prisoners of war. Huh. And then there's the hypocrisy in it all. I'd have sent them all away, he says, with a feast of joy, with music, songs, and timbrels and harps. And it would have been a heart-rending scene. Me, the father-in-law, your father-in-law, with my daughters and my grandchildren, kissing them and hugging them one by one. Really? Laban makes out that he has a really close relationship with his daughters and grandchildren. What did his daughters say last week? Verse 14. Is there yet any portion or inheritance for us, Rachel and Leah, in our father's house? Are we not counted of him strangers? For he hath sold us, and hath quite devoured also our money. Lies and hypocrisy. But Jacob's not innocent either. Jacob should have, first of all, trusted God's promise given at Bethel. Remember, before he came to Haran, before he met Laban, God said to him, your seed will be numerous and spread to the north, south, east, and west. Genesis 28, verse 15, 14. And verse 15 says, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to keep you wherever you go. I'm going to bring you back to this land. And I won't leave you until I've done all that I've spoken to you. And Jacob, believing that promise, should have realized that the God who terrified Laban in that dream the night before, and so restrained him, could have easily defended him, so that Jacob should have told Laban, openly and above board, God has told me to come back to the promised land. You always knew that I was going to return. That was the way I came to you in the first place. I've done the work required, and now I'm leaving. And because he didn't, because he thought that he was wiser than God in this one, yet again, it looked like he was a thief, especially when Laban can come in and twist it. It looked like he had dishonored his father-in-law. And again, Jacob, in his great wisdom, has ruined his witness in the land. His witness before Laban, his witness before Laban's family and workers, and his witness before the whole town of Haran. And what is God doing through this tirade of Laban's against Jacob? Always a key question, by the way. What is God doing here? What's the point of this in our own lives as well as in the scriptures? Remember, he could have easily stopped Laban from even getting to Jacob on Mount Galilee. And the answer is that God allowed and willed Laban to come catch up and rebuke Jacob, because he's using Jacob's accusations to chasten Jacob. Setting aside now Jacob's sinful, Laban's sinful anger, Laban's lies and hypocrisy, Jacob's conscience must have stung, because there was a grain of truth in his father-in-law's charges. Though not in the way that Laban meant it. And then his father-in-law related his dream of the night before. Verse 29. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. But the God of your father spake unto me yesternight, saying, take thou heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. And he says this not to glorify God, but to glorify himself. I want you to know that I had the power to harm you. And just unless God had said it, I would have done that. Think about that. And God here again is speaking to Jacob through this. There was no need for you to sneak away from Haran. You should have simply told everyone what you were doing. This way you would have spared yourself all this reproach. Because I, as the God who sent Laban this dream, would surely have protected you. My promise is tied up with you. I couldn't let you suffer. I told you you would have a great seed, so you can't lose your wives and children. I told you you'd come back to the land, so you have to be assured that you're going to make it home. And so Jacob, yet again, you're almost tempted to sigh at this point, is running ahead of God and trying to give God a hand, because after all, Jehovah is the sort of God, Jacob thinks, who needs me to come along to help him fulfill his promises, because God would be lost without me. I have to use certain shifts. I have to be deceitful and use guile. But Jacob should have learned that this isn't the way to do things. He should have learned after he tried this with the birthright in Genesis 25. He should have learned when he tried this with the blessing in Genesis 27. He should have learned when he tried this with the peeled rods in Genesis 30, that God fulfills his promise not because of his machinations, but in spite of his sinful manipulations. And now God is saying to them, you took advantage of Laban's sheep shearing to leave him craftily and secretly. You shouldn't have done that. You're only making things worse for yourself. You're making a difficult situation harder, not easier. And sometimes in the church, there are people like that. When there's a controversy, instead of letting the controversy even run its proper course in the biblical methods according to the church order. If so-and-so's doing something wrong, well then I'm going to try and do this, and then they break, and all they do is complicate the case, make things worse, almost let off the hook the person who's in the wrong in the first place. You don't do things that way. And then Laban lands what he thinks is his sucker punch. He's a generous man, Laban, according to his own lights. I understand, I'm sure how gracious I am. I understand that you want to return to your father's house. But why did you have to steal my images? Jacob, and this is sort of like a lawyer summing up his case at the end. Jacob, you're not only a kidnapper. You're not only a dishonor of your superiors, but you're also a thief. You are a sacrilegious thief. Friend of God, you stole my images. Now Jacob, who's been sitting taking this, responds briefly. He parries the first blow. Why did you steal away and didn't tell me? Jacob says, okay, you want to know? Verse 31, I was afraid. And that's true, he was afraid. Because I said, perhaps he's going to come and take his daughters from me. That was honest. That was honest. That is what he thought. That's probably the most honest thing he says without any manipulation in this passage, our text. But he shouldn't have feared this, because God had given him the promise 20 years ago at Bethel. And as for the second charge, that I have stolen your images, Jacob says, verse 32, with whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. So far am I from approving of this or engaging in this. I think the death penalty is appropriate for anybody who steals your idols. Before our brethren, discern thou what is thine with me, and take it to thee. For Jacob didn't know that Rachel had stolen him. And if he knew that Rachel had stolen him, he wouldn't have been talking about the thief being put to death. And it is interesting that Rachel will soon die. Immediately upon bearing Benjamin and fulfilling her own prophecy at the birth of Joseph, which name means in its context, God will add to me another son. Well, as soon as that other son comes, namely Benjamin, she did die. But Jacob never imagined that Rachel had taken the images, and never imagined that his beloved wife would die in that way. We spoke earlier of Laban's 7-day pursuit. Now we have his equally furious 5-tent search. Verse 33, Laban went into Jacob's tent. Interesting which of the 5 tents he checks first. He has some opinion of Jacob. Bet you he stole it himself. And then he goes into Leah's tent, who was, after all, Jacob's first wife. And then into the 2 maidservants' tents, Bilhah and Zilpah. Those 2 women were the next mothers of Jacob's children. But he didn't find them. So he went out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. And all the while, of course, Laban's brethren and Jacob's household are waiting. And Jacob's looking on especially, and when he goes into the first tent, fancy, knew it wasn't that, I didn't have it in my tent. Then he goes into see? Oh good. Aha, we're going to get him now. And then he goes into the 2, and he comes out of, okay. He's feeling better and better, right? Meanwhile, there's another person looking eagerly long, Rachel, and she shows herself to be a very cool customer. Because she has hidden the images, not in her tent, although maybe they were in the tent, and she actually took them out of the tent, fearing a search, but now they're in her camel's saddle or under her camel's saddle. And she's just sitting there. And she says to her father, "Oh, let it not displease my lord, because I can't rise up for you, because the custom of women is upon me." She's pleading her period here in verse 35. And the question can only be asked, I don't think if it can be answered, is she lying? Maybe she is. Maybe she isn't, but Laban doesn't want to test it, and he's not interested at all, because he understands that she's going to be in those conditions, none too keen to get off her camel's saddle, and he's going to be none too keen to examine her camel's saddle, because physically and hygienically things were not so good back then. And also perhaps there could well have been the issue of ceremonial uncleanness. In the Levitical law, later admittedly, hundreds of years later, if a menstruous woman sits on something, including a saddle, that thing is unclean. So if anyone touches it, then they are ceremonially unclean. Now that law, as I said, came in later, but oftentimes, before the Mosaic law, these laws were also in that part of the world in practice to some extent. But it wasn't codified as it would later be under Moses. So here's Rachel, and we're learning another side of Rachel. She possesses a sinful guile too, and you've got to say, it's only what you would expect. Who's her father? Laban. Laban's up to all sorts of tricks. Who's her husband? Jacob. Some of it's rubbing off on her. The apple hasn't fallen too far from the tree. And when you think about it, this passage is a devastating critique of idols, comparable in its own way to some of the material in the latter chapters of the book of Isaiah, especially in Isaiah 40s. What use are idols? They can be stolen. What's the sense, therefore, in praying to an idol to protect you? So do you suffer no harm when the very idol or images themselves can be stolen and are utterly defenseless? And here's an idol, and it's being carried on the back of a 2 or 1 humped camel. So much for these idols being the creators and upholders of the universe. And here's this idol, all holy and spotlessly pure, and it's being sat upon by a menstruous woman. Lovely. And here's this idol, and Laban has been diligently seeking it now for 7 days and through 5 tents. He's a devotee, but he's seeking, but he cannot find. Whereas Jehovah promises, seek and ye shall find. And everyone who seeks, every last one who seeks, always finds. The problem is with those who don't find is that they never really were seeking. Not with all their heart, not sincere. And so verse 35 concludes, Laban searched, but found not the images. Now you understand how these sorts of confrontations and arguments go. Now the boot is on the other foot. It's Jacob's turn to be indignant and to make, on his part, accusations. We read that Jacob was wroth and showed with or rebuked Laban. And now Jacob strikes back with his own sense of injustice that has been perpetrated against him. You see, Jacob, previously he's on the back foot, and people don't like being on the back foot. But Laban has overreached himself, with the result being that the pendulum springs back the other way, because Laban hasn't found the images in Jacob's camp. And this in turn weakens his other charges too, which were, anyway, overstated. And now Jacob, we would say, wades right into him. Verse 36. What is my trespass? He's all sanctimonious and holy now. What is my trespass? What is my sin that thou hast so hotly pursued after me? And you can imagine him pausing a little bit here, and wagging his head and nodding, and looking at the crowd around and seeing if they get the point. Now, whereas thou hast searched all my stuff, what have you found among all my household stuff? Huh? What have you found? Now, set it out before your brethren and before my brethren. Put it all, make it public, so all the parties can judge. Set it out there. I don't see you moving, Laban. I don't see you bringing anything. Are you not showing here the two camps? Your camp and my camp. They're both judges. And ultimately, God is the judge. And I would guess that many, if not all of you, have seen scenes like this over the years. A verbal combat where the first party overstates his case. And he makes rash and unproven and sometimes unprovable charges. And we hope these aren't the sorts of conversations you have with your husband or your wife. And then, overstating the case, not able to prove it, then there's a reaction. And then it comes back on his own head. He gets a taste of his own medicine, does Laban, or does the person in the conversation that you might just be thinking about. And he gets, to use a similar metaphor, he gets a slice of humble pie given to him. This sort of passage in Genesis 31 is a warning for us to avoid sinful anger, which can easily lead to rash accusations and exaggerations. That is, lies. And this passage teaches us that we must avoid these things, not only, although this is the chief thing, not only because these are sins against the sixth and the eighth commandments, but also, as is the case here, you could well end up losing an awful lot of face before others. And God, in heaven, doesn't think that such a chastisement is beneath him to administer. He believes that this is a very fitting chastisement or judgment for people who do this sort of thing. This is what you want to bring upon them: rash, foolish, overstated, exaggerated, lying, bitter, invective. Now you've gone too far. You're going to hang by the rope you tried to put on someone else's neck. And then Jacob, because he's crafty and he knows how to talk a word or two, then he really starts to turn the screws on Laban. He says, "You want to talk to me about justice and what I've done to you? Right, now you shut up. And I'll give you a taste of my mind. I have given you 20 years of faithful, painful, costly shepherding." Verse 38. "This 20 years have I been with thee. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young." I've worked for you a long time. And I have cared for the mothers of your flock sedulously. "The rams of thy flock have I not eaten. In all those years, I never once helped myself to your cattle." You go a long way, Laban, around Haran before you'd find a shepherd like that. Verse 39. "That which was torn of beasts, I brought it not unto thee. I bear the loss of it." Who in this world wouldn't want an employee who, if he made a mistake, said, "Look, boss," not only owned up to it instead of the boss having to work out who made the mistake, but actually said, "Look, I realize it was my fault. I broke that piece, and here, take it out of my wages." You're hired. You're hired right away if a boss thinks that of you. Jacob has quite a testimony, at least in this regard. Verse 40, "Thus I was." You're tempted almost to bring out the fiddles and mourn here. Thus I was in the day. The drought consumed me. There he is on the hills in the heat, the poor man sweating and hot without a cool drink. And the frost by night, because when those skies are cloudless, it can get very, very cold, even in the Middle East at night. And my sleep departed from my eyes. I was so vigilant, I was suffering sleep deprivation for you. And you can imagine now, the onlookers are beginning to respond a bit differently to this confrontation. Jacob's household, his wives and sons and retainers, are saying to themselves, Dad, or my husband, or my... He's actually on the right here. Though, of course, Jacob, as is his wont, he's leaving out his own sins in the last 20 years. And Laban's brethren are beginning to... another side to this. This doesn't seem to be all with Laban. And Laban himself, he doesn't care for this rebuke. Jacob then continues, rubbing it in, recounting the old grievances, the old labor grievances with Laban that have been racking up in his mind for 20 years. Of my own hand didst thou require it. That is, when one of the animals were killed, let's say by a bear or a wolf. Not only did I pay you willingly what was lost on my watch, but you required me to do this. Whether it was stone by day or stone by night when everybody else is sleeping. So that I, Jacob, at times worked for nothing, or even lost money working for you, paying for the privilege of building up your flock. And then he summarizes his 20 years service, and you could even say 20 years servitude, with these words. Thus, verse 41, have I been 20 years in thy house. He's nodding. This is the way it's been. Yeah. 20 years in thy house. I have served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, and 6 years for thy cattle or livestock, especially, as we said earlier, the sheep and the goats. And you changed my wages 10 times. And when you hear that 10 times, you think, oh, he's changed wages. When did he do that? Well, go back for a bit. Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, but it turned out to be 7 years for Leah. There's wage change number one, and the dirt and scum of it all on his very wedding night. And then you had me, you see. You had me for another 7 years, because you knew that she was the one I loved, so you got 14 years out of me. But what could I say? I was in the back foot. I was in a weak position. I had to agree, and you took advantage of me. And then, when we made the deal about me getting the marked cattle, the speckled, spotted, and streaked ones, that very day, you went through the flock with and took all the marked cattle 3 days' journey away, contrary to our arrangement, because I was supposed to go through the flock and take those ones for my flock. And then, Genesis 31, verses 7 and 8 says this, Jacob's words to his two chief wives, your father hath deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, same phrase as is in our text, but God suffered him not to hurt me. If he said thus, more proof of changed wages, the speckled should be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. And if he changed it again, to the ring stakes shall be thy hire, then bear all the cattle ring stakes. So there was obviously even more toings and froings and changing and reneging on deals, and we're not even able to reconstruct it all. It may well be, as I said last week, that it wasn't literally 10 times they changed his, Laban changed Jacob's wages in the same way that we would say, I've told you 12 times, keep the television off, but you went and turned it on. And we don't literally mean 12 times. But I would guess that there were other changes which aren't specifically mentioned in the sacred text. And then finally, Jacob, after laying out his side of the case, brings in the supreme judge in all controversies, both in religion and in labor disputes.
And maybe some of you have had labor disputes too, with changing wages and a devious boss who's out to get as much work out of you for as little as possible. Jacob says, verse 42, "Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me." And now you can see what Jacob thinks of Laban. "Surely thou had sent me away now empty." No wives, no children, no flocks after 20 years. That's the sort of man you are. And you started this argument. "But for God, but the Lord has seen mine affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked thee yesterday." And you can't help but thinking that Jacob was thinking inside himself, "You deserved it. You richly deserved it, and I'm glad he did." And here we have an appeal on Jacob's part to the true God, the God of the covenant, who always keeps his promises. He calls this God the God of Abraham, and he was Abraham's God from the time he called him out of Ur of the Chaldees to the rest of his life on earth, and he is Abraham's God still today, because as Christ said, echoing a similar text in Exodus 3, "God is not the God of the dead, but of the living." Abraham's still alive because God isn't Abraham's dead, Abraham's God, if Abraham is simply a dead body mouldering in the cave of Machpelah and doesn't continue to exist as to his soul or spirit. God is the God of Abraham right now, just as he was in Genesis 31 when Abraham was already in heaven, which teaches the intermediate state that before the great coming day of God and Jesus Christ, the saints who die go to be with Christ in heaven, awaiting the bodily resurrection on the last day. The true God is the God of Abraham. And the fear of Isaac. And this phrase, "the fear of Isaac," means that he is the God whom Isaac fears with a divine and religious awe. The one whom Isaac, who is still living on earth in the time of Genesis 31, was fearing each day, as well as the God of Abraham in heaven. And unless that God had been with me, surely, it's absolutely certain, you would have sent me away now empty. That is, you would have come upon me and stripped me of my flocks, my wives, and even my children. And you ask, is that really what he was planning to do? And I think it is. And as we see this evening, Lord willing, Laban doesn't even contradict it. "God hath seen," these are his concluding words, "God hath seen mine affliction, the 20 years of pure grief that you put me through, and the labor of my hands, the hard work I put in, and he rebuked you last night." And that was true too, although Jacob was not without guilt either. Three concluding observations on all this, beloved. In this passage, as in so many other places in Genesis 31, we see the faithfulness of the God of the covenant to all of his elect and erring people. And all the scrapes that we get into because we don't trust and obey. And we see, secondly, beloved, the weakness of even the godliness of the best of saints. Because Scripture, and therefore these sermons, they're both critical of Jacob. Because Jacob sinned. And he sinned repeatedly, and he sinned in the same basic way with the same basic problem. And yet, despite all of that, we're not saying we're any better than Jacob. We're saying the opposite. He had a lot of hard times. But we still have to, because the Bible does, deal with his sins as a warning to us all. And hence we see, third and finally, our own need for the forgiveness of sins in the cross of Jesus Christ.
And we see our own need for our righteousness, which is much, much infinitely greater than our own righteousness, which is the righteousness of God in Jesus Christ. The only way in which any of us can stand before the whole world on the last day, when other people would want to accuse us for our sins too. And the only way we can stand before the holy God of all purity. Amen.